All right, Isaiah 41. All right, remember that we have the book of Isaiah divided into basically three parts. You have the first part, we're dealing with the lead-up to the Assyrian invasion. We have the historical interlude, which really is the culmination of that. It gives us a transition. You have the Assyrians defeated by the Lord. And then you have a shift, and then you have a prophecy that is given at the end of chapter 39, where Hezekiah is told that all that is there in Jerusalem, all the wealth, all the treasures, all the stuff that's there is going to be carried off to Babylon. And Babylon was not perceived at that time as an enemy. It was a city that was itself under the heel of the Assyrians. And had not arisen to an empire, hadn't been an independent entity for any length of time, for a long time. Occasionally they would break free from Assyria, and that might last for anywhere from a few months to even a decade or two, but it never lasted very long. And now they have been told that the Babylonians will come eventually and take away all that is there. And so the balance of the book deals with encouragement because they know that they'll be carried off into captivity. That's been told. Isaiah has given that revelation, and so there's that expectation. Now, we have all these promises that have gone before, all the covenants, all the different things that God has given to the children of Israel as far as their being a perpetual nation. They are God's covenant people. They will be in the land sometime in the future. And so the balance of the book deals with off and on encouragement. It deals with Babylon, and it deals with encouragement to the Israelites to let them know that they will be back in land, that God is indeed going to fulfill his promise. And so we have the way of deliverance that God is going to use to bring them back, at least initially, into the land. That the captivity there in Babylon is going to be for a short period of time. From the first deportation until they're allowed to come back is going to be 70 years. And that's revealed in Jeremiah. But he's going to give a window here. He says there in the beginning of the chapter, he says, "Keep silence before me, O islands." When you read the word islands, it's the idea of coastlands, especially dealing with the Mediterranean. "And let the people renew their strength. Let them come near. Let them speak. Let us come together in judgment." Now, let me preface this by saying he's not addressing Israel. He's talking to the nations there along the Mediterranean coast. Nations as a whole, really, but especially those. A lot of nations we're talking about. We're talking about the Egyptians. We're talking about the Phoenicians. We're talking about the Lydians, which are mentioned just a couple of times in the scripture. Anybody here old enough, dare I say this? Ooh, that was a bad way of prefacing it. Old enough to remember the expression "rich as Croesus." Anybody here familiar? My wife is old enough to remember that. My son is old enough to remember that. Good. It's an old figure of speech. Croesus was the last king of the Lydians. Lydia was a kingdom that occupied the western third, maybe two-fifths of what is now Turkey. And he was extremely wealthy because it's kind of interesting. If you were to take all the gold that is that has been refined and so on in the world today, and you were to make a cube, I don't have the stat right here, but it's only something like 60 feet square. There's only that much gold in the world that's been refined. And when you consider how much was how much the Aztecs had and the Incas, how much that the ancient Egyptians had and so on, that there, a lot of it has been available for a long time. It's kind of interesting to consider the fact that perhaps either the gold that's in your teeth or on your wedding ring or something like that might be a remnant of something that was once part of some 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000 year old artifact at one point in time that's been melted down and then remade into something else and then melted down, various pillaging and so on during the course of history. But anyway, getting all back to that you had what were called electrum mines in Lydia. Electrum is a natural, I'm a biologist. Hybrid is the word I'm coming up with. Alloy of silver and gold, and it was readily available there. And so he had. By the way, he's also the guy that invented coins. Coins didn't exist prior to that time, and so very wealthy fellow. But anyway, the the people there, the people in Greece, the people in Carthage and so on, all these different places around the world. He says, keep silence before me, O islands, all coastlands, and let the people renew their strength. Which people are going to renew their strength? He tells the islands to keep silent and let the people renew their strength. For the people who have their strength renewed are the Jews. Because what is bad news for everybody else is going to be good news for the Jews. And that's the key to this chapter. Bad news for everybody else, good news for the Jews. So God is going to bring the nations together for judgment. And he tells them to keep quiet because he has the charge. First, he's going to present the case. And he says there in verse 2, who, referring to himself, the Lord is going to do this, who raised up the righteous man from the east. Now, he's not named here. He doesn't get named until chapter, I think, 44. And this is going to be Cyrus. Cyrus the Persian. And let me give you a little background on Cyrus. Cyrus was the founder of the Persian Empire. Sometimes referred to as Cyrus the Great. Not the pretty good, but the great. His tomb is still there in Iran until the lunatics decide to bomb it, blow it up. Although there's no idols on the outside because he was a Zoroastrian. Cyrus, the Persians were a small outfit in what is now Iran. Iran prior to 1933 was called Persia, and the Medes were the main guys. He married the daughter of the king of the Medes. And his brother was actually king of the Persians. Well, his brother died, evidently under natural causes. Evidently. Because this guy here was actually not a really nasty guy like so many of the ancient kings. He was actually a pretty good fellow, as this kind of guy goes. but anyway, he succeeded his brother. And then after a little while, he went to war with his father-in-law and defeated him. But didn't totally, you know, grind him away or anything else like that. They made peace afterward, but he let his father-in-law know that, hey, I'm the boss. I'm in charge. We're starting something big here. And what we're going to do is instead of you being under my heel, let's just combine forces, but we're going to be the more important of the two. And so you have what is called the Medo-Persian Empire. And so he gains that piece of territory. And then he moves further west, and he goes up and over the top. And the Assyrians are taken out. We're familiar with that. And he goes further west, and he takes out all these little petty kingdoms in what is now northern Iraq, or where Iran and Turkey come together, and in eastern Turkey. He goes all the way across, and he goes all the way over to the Aegean Sea, and he takes out the Lydians. So he has all of Turkey, northern Iraq, and the western half of what is now Iran. And so he, after he's done all that, he takes 20 years to do all that, and then he goes south. And he goes down into Mesopotamia, and he takes out Babylon. And he is the king of Persia that we read about in Daniel chapter 5, where you have the handwriting on the wall and so on. His general, Darius, was on the outside laying siege, but he was the king of the empire that took out Babylon and incorporated it into his empire. And one of the first things that Cyrus did was... he issued a decree. And I want you to keep your finger here, and I want you to go to the very end of 2 Chronicles. 2 Chronicles chapter 36. And it says in verse 22, now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord spoken by the mouth of Jeremiah might be accomplished, the 70 years, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia. Now it's the Lord that does this. And we're going to come back into that in Isaiah 41 as well. That he made a proclamation throughout all of his kingdom, all the vast empire that he had conquered, put it also in writing, made a decree, thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, all the kingdoms of the earth hath the Lord God of heaven given me, and he hath charged me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Who is there among you of all his people? Let the Lord his God be with him, and let him go up. And by the way, the Cyrus cylinder that they have found is very, very similar in wording to this. It's if you will, an archaeological confirmation of what we have here. So the Jews were said, you can go back. You can go back. And the first half of the book of Ezra is all about that. The first half of the book of Ezra, Ezra's not there. He's talking about what went on a generation and a half before his time, or two generations before his time. And so they go back and they rebuild the temple. And it was a long process, long, tedious process, but they came back, and about 20 plus thousand people came back, and they resettled the land of the ancient land of Judah. But it was Cyrus that allowed them to go back, that the captivity was ended. And so God is going to raise up this guy, Cyrus. By the way, just to give you a heads up on this, go to chapter 44 in Isaiah and look at the last verse. That saith of Cyrus, he is my shepherd and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying to Jerusalem, thou shalt be built, and to the temple thy foundation shall be laid. Cyrus hadn't been born yet when this was written. As a matter of fact, Cyrus's father hadn't been born yet. Matter of fact, I think probably Cyrus's grandfather hadn't been born yet when this was written. And so God had singled out this man, because God knows the end from the beginning. The future is just as certain as the present or the past to God. That God had singled out this man to accomplish his purpose. So, coming back to chapter 41, who raised up the righteous man from the east. That is Cyrus. However, let's deal with the... It's kind of funny. If you read the commentaries and stuff, it's amazing what they settle on, where the controversies come from. And the big controversy in the first half of this chapter, anyway, is this word, righteous. And there in verse 2, who raised up the righteous from the east, in reference to Cyrus. Now, Cyrus was not a believer. All right, we just read his decree, but understand that he sent out several other decrees about other nationalities, letting them go home at the same time. And he said glowing things about their gods as well. He was basically, if you're looking at it from strictly a political perspective, he was basically trying to gain the backing, the accolades and so on of his subjects, that they were not going to be under the heel and so on like the Persians and especially the Assyrians had done. But he was going to make, other than demanding tribute and so on, he wasn't going to make life difficult on these folks. That you can go back and you can live as you have always lived, and you can live in your homeland, and you can worship your gods, and you can have your temple, and you can do all the things that you used to do before you became subjects. But just make sure that the revenue keeps coming in. But you can do as you please apart from that. And that, for the most part, is how the Persians operated. They were, other than fleecing the sheep pretty heavily, they were benevolent dictators. And that became pretty standard policy thereafter. The Romans, to some extent, were that way, especially in the first half of the empire, and the Greeks in between the two. And so when it says he's a righteous man, righteous is not just in reference to God's righteousness. If somebody is righteous, we can also deal with the concept of just. Now, I'm going to give you two possible interpretations of the passage here. One is just. Now, somebody who is just is somebody who is dealing in the realm of justice. And Cyrus, one of the reasons he was great, besides having built a great empire and so on, is the fact that he was as ancient rulers went, a pretty just guy. He was fair in his dealings. And so that might be a possibility, but also you're dealing with the fact that Cyrus is unwittingly, just as Nebuchadnezzar was before, he is unwittingly the tool of God. And so what we've got here is Cyrus is acting as the agent of God to bring about justice. He is dealing with Babylon. Remember that when we're dealing with individuals, if an individual commits a crime, then society, with their laws and so on, takes them and punishes them accordingly. In a just society, you have the, murder, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, restitution for robbery and so on. That's a just society. There aren't too many just societies in the world today, but you get the idea. If you have a nation, however, that commits a crime, it works on a totally different scale, because you can't have a disgruntled citizen who begins to realize, hey, we got some serious problems here in Babylon. I mean, look at what we're doing here. This was just not right. And he marches up those steps into the palace, walks through the hanging gardens and confronts the king and says, hey, listen, we're out of line and we need to be punished as a nation. So what are we going to do about it? That doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen. People are going to bend over backwards to justify themselves. We do that here. And Habakkuk is a very interesting book. It deals with this very idea. Habakkuk is complaining. He's pouring his heart out to God and saying, God, look at how bad Judah is. I mean, it is just awful. They are neglecting the worship of the true God. They are involved in Baal worship. There is violence. There is all this stuff going on. And God, what are you going to do about it? And God says, I'll tell you what I'm going to do about it. I'm going to send the Babylonians and they're going to sack Jerusalem. And Habakkuk goes, you can't do that. They're worse than we are. Yeah, I mean, he's going to thank his idols for enabling him to sack Jerusalem. You can't do this. And God says, well, then when he's done, then I will deal with him. And that's what we've got here. With Cyrus. Cyrus is God's tool to bring about justice in dealing with Babylon. Among other things. And so the two ideas is that he was a pretty good guy and was just. I think that's the much lesser likelihood. I think the other one is that he's the agent to bring about God's justice is the main point there. And from the east, if you look at a map... I know you guys got me some maps and so on. What I want is a great big pull down so I can do this, get my little laser pointer and do the whole thing. Yeah. And my wife is saying, well, all you have to do is get, what's the thing there? What do you want me to get?
I don't talk like that.
PowerPoint. Thank you. One of these days. I have a cell phone and a PC. That's pretty good for me. I'm a Luddite. I'd probably be driving a horse and carriage and have a beard and a flat hat. All right, so if you look at a map, I'm trying to remember where I came from, where did I get PowerPoint from? If we look at a map, Israel. But remember, you didn't get there by going straight across because you've got this horrible desert in between that in those days you couldn't really cross. Even if you had a camel caravan to take a week or two to cross that, you couldn't do it. Camels can't go that long without water. And so you had to go up and over the top, the Fertile Crescent that you remember from junior high social studies. And so Iran is, Persia is due east, and then they would come in from the north. And so from the east, calling him to his foot and gave the nations before him and made him rule over the kings. He gave them as the dust to his sword and as driven stubble to his bow. Look at a phrase here. Called him to his foot. What is that? We are so far removed from the idea of an absolute monarchy. Okay, Aaron, you're... They would bow their heads and touch the toe of his foot with their foreheads in homage and submission to him. That's the idea. And he's saying that Cyrus is doing that unwittingly to the Lord. He is the Lord's tool. He is the Lord's servant. He doesn't know it. He is king of the greatest empire that has existed up to this point. But he doesn't know it. But he is the servant of the Lord. And that same idea is used for Nebuchadnezzar and a couple of other people as well. And so he talks about the fact that he's unstoppable as far as an empire is concerned, as far as going to battle. He pursued them and passed safely, even by the way that he had not gone with his feet. The Assyrians, we've talked about this, went through a number of pulses. The Assyrians would go out, and they when they had a really ambitious guy and a big standing army, and then because you had high casualties and so on, they couldn't sustain the thing, and then it would come back in, it would shrink to something they could maintain, and then their population would build up, and they'd wait until they had another ambitious king, and then the thing would go like this, and it went through a number of these stages. Whereas the Persians started out as a little territory in western Iran, and then they came this bigger piece because they swallowed that up, and then they're going to take this, and he keeps going out to places he's never been before. The Persians had never been to these places, and he's conquering places he's never been before. He's sightseeing as he's conquering, seeing all these things and going all these places that a way he has not gone with his feet. Who hath wrought and done it? Calling the generation from the beginning. I, the Lord, the first and the last, I am he. God is saying, I'm the one that has brought this all to pass. This is not Cyrus. Cyrus is my tool. I am the one wielding the tool. Cyrus is my tool. Cyrus is my servant. He is accomplishing my purpose. Cyrus doesn't know it, but that's what he's doing. Now, we have a little bit of a shift here. We're going to change the course. He's been addressing the nations, but also dealing with Israel is going to get a benefit from this. And then here's the reaction from the nations that are looking to the east and watching Cyrus come, the warning that has been issued. The isles, the coastlands saw it and feared, and the ends of the earth were afraid, draw near and came. So the reaction is one of dread of what is going to come. And they helped everyone his neighbor. There were various coalitions and so on to try to put a stop to this, to try to keep the Persians from coming and overrunning them. And they were trying to encourage each other. They said, be of good courage. So the carpenter, and here's what they did. You would think that they would do, to some extent, what Hezekiah did. Hezekiah rebuilt the walls of the city of Jerusalem when the Assyrians came, before the Assyrians came. And he went through the land and he stopped up all the springs of water. He disguised them. He capped them so that the water wouldn't be available and the Assyrians wouldn't know where to look for it. And so when they came, they had to bring their water from afar if they were going to maintain the siege, making it very, very difficult for them. They reaped all the crops they possibly could and put them in storage so that the Assyrians wouldn't have any food to get to live off the land. They did everything possible, building armaments, and fortifying their cities and so on, and getting rid of all the access to anything that would be a benefit to the Assyrians. And these folks are doing the same thing. They start with that, but then they do this. So the carpenter encouraged the goldsmith, and he that smootheth with the hammer, him that smote the anvil, saying, it is ready for the soldering. They didn't. The idea there is the gilding of it. You're going to take the gold leaf that you have hammered out, and you're going to apply it to something. And he fastened it with nails that it should not be moved. What are they talking about? Are they talking about fortifications? What are they gilding? What are they covering with gold? An idol. Boy, the Persians are coming. Man, we got to make ourselves some gods that'll help us. And that's exactly what it's saying. The Persians are coming. We're in trouble. I mean, we are in really a bad, bad condition. Let's make us some gods that'll help us. And Isaiah does this a couple of times. They're at the end of verse 7, and with nails that it should not be moved. We talked about this last week when we were talking about Dagon in the Philistine temple. David, would you come here for a second? Actually, never mind. I'm going to use something else. Because for him, it's too hard. Don't tell anybody I did this. La, la, la. Let's make sure we're good. Okay. Here's our statue. Here's our idol. Okay. We've made it. And what are we going to do once we got this thing made? We are going to fasten it with nails that it should not be moved. Why do we have to fasten it with nails? Is it going to walk away? So, because our God that is going to rescue us has a tendency to have that happen to it. It tips over. All right? It's going to tip over. It's going to tip over. Is a God who cannot stand up on its own and has to be fastened in place, capable of rescuing them from the Persians? No. He's trying to point out to these folks how ridiculous this idea is. Now, from our perspective, we sit there and chuckle at these folks. Good grief, what kind of idiots are these people? But that was the mindset. That's what they thought. The idea that gods can be made and that they actually exist. And might be able to help us. Now he's going to contrast the nations, who are all pagan, with Israel. Verse 8. But thou, Israel, you're different. Thou art my servant, Jacob, in whom I have chosen, the seed of Abraham, my friend. Thou whom I have taken from the ends of the earth and called thee from the chief men thereof, and said unto thee, thou art my servant, and I have chosen thee and not cast thee away. This is based on covenant promises that God had made before. So God is singling out this people based on promises that he has made before. He's giving comfort to the folks there in Israel, or of Israel. And he says there in verse 10, fear thou not, for I am with thee. Be not dismayed, for I am thy God. I will strengthen thee, yea, I will help thee, yea, I will uphold thee with the right hand of my righteousness. And so there's this comfort, there's this encouragement. You're going to be sustained. It's looking bad, but I'm going to single you out. I'm going to sustain you. And so we go through the long list of nations that show up in your Old Testament history and think about how many of these folks are still actually in existence as far as separate entities. Their heirs are here, but they've been absorbed by other peoples and so on. They don't stand out. They are no longer, the vast majority of them, separate entities. They are no longer peoples that are still in existence today. We talk about the Iranians and being the equivalent to the Persians. No, actually the Persians would be, it's kind of like saying the folks from Idaho Americans are all people from Idaho. It doesn't work the other way around. People from Idaho are Americans, but not all Americans are from folks from Idaho. And so the Persians are not everybody in Iran. The people of Persia are actually a little component, ethnically, of the people of Iran. At least that's the way it was in ancient times. But they've been absorbed into this broader idea. And so Israel is encouraged. God has sustained them. He has singled them out. And then he talks about their enemies. This is what's going to happen to their enemies, because they've always been surrounded by enemies. Israel have a whole lot of allies throughout your Old Testament history. The only allies they had were fair weather allies, and that would be the Phoenicians, and that was because they were commercial partners. And when things went real bad, they were more than willing to sell the captives, the war captives that were of Israel, into slavery off to Greece or someplace else. They were more than willing to do that. Fair weather friends at best. So they were not surrounded by allies or friends. Always enemies. And so he says in verse 11, behold, all they that were incensed against thee, all those who were enraged against you, shall be ashamed and confounded. They shall be as nothing. They that strive with thee shall perish. Now, some of them did around this time. Some of them did during the time of the Persians. And some are still there today. So we're looking at kingdom fulfillment in some of these things. Verse 12. Thou shalt seek them and shalt not find them, even them that contended with thee. They that war against thee shall be as nothing and as a thing of naught. Again, we're looking for kingdom fulfillment of these things because we're still dealing with Israel surrounded by hostile enemies that are enraged against the Jewish people. For I, the Lord, verse 13, will hold thy right hand, saying unto thee, fear not, I will help thee. It's like a frightened child and the parent coming in holding the hand says, I'll take care of it. I'll take care of it. Fear not, thou worm Jacob. You wondered where Isaac Watts got it. Well, this is one of the places where he got it. And worm theology, which some theologians decry and so on, is true. It's true. We are nothing better than worms in the eyes of God, but he in his grace and mercy has saved us in spite of that. Fear not, thou worm Jacob, and ye men of Israel. I will help thee, saith the Lord, and thy Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. That word Redeemer is the same word. If you go to the book of Ruth, and you have Naomi and Ruth coming back to Bethlehem, and they're there for a little while. They're there at the beginning of barley harvest, and she goes out gleaning and so on. And Naomi says, shall I not find, it says, rest for you. Now, this doesn't mean, you know, you've been working awful hard. Let's just take a little break here, shall we? That isn't the word there. That word is normally translated redeemer. It's the Hebrew word goel. And in that culture, in that day, women were scroungers at best. If they were either married or they were scroungers or living off of the generosity of family members. They didn't have businesses and so on in that day. It just wasn't culturally acceptable. And so, shall I not give you a rest? What she's saying is, honey, I'm going to get you a husband. And she did. She did in sort of a sly roundabout way. She did. And, but that's the word. And that's the word here. The Lord is their redeemer. Redemption, if you go through the law of Moses, is the idea that you are, somebody has been sold into slavery because of debt. And the Redeemer will buy them back from their debt, redeeming them. And our debt, of course, is that of sin. And so the Lord is the Holy One. He is buying back Israel not only from the debt of sin, but also from the debt that has sold them into slavery into the surrounding nations. And by the way, other than a brief window during the Maccabees, from the time Babylon took Jerusalem until 1948, they have always been under somebody else. There has not been a time until recently where the Jews have been an independent people ruling themselves. And they're still not there in faith. That's not the ultimate fulfillment of the passages we have as far as Israel's restoration is concerned, because they're not there in faith. And then he says, so he's got the redemption and so on, and then the tables are turned, starting in verse 15. Behold, I will make thee a new sharp threshing instrument, having teeth. And thou shalt thresh the mountains and beat them small and make the hills as chaff. What's a threshing instrument? Pardon me? No. If you were to take, imagine an old door made out of 2x6s with a couple of cross pieces on it to hold it together. Great big, huge, thick, rough door. And have it be maybe 4 feet wide. Big, huge door. And you were to drive great big, huge railroad spikes through that thing. So they're sticking out the other side, you know, yay far. And then you were to put a ring, a big metal ring on the end of that thing. And hitch that to a donkey or to an ox. And here I've got a threshing floor, maybe something the size of this room. And I brought all my harvested grain and piled it here. And it's a hard packed floor. And I take that ox and I go figure eights and loop-de-loops and circles and all through this. And I drag that thing. I'm standing on that door with the spikes down. And we're running through all those sheaves of grain that have been piled up there. And it's separating the grain from the chaff. That's your threshing sledge. And a new one with sharp teeth on it. And God is going to have Israel be the one that drives down the mountains. Now, we're not talking so much the idea of physical mountains being, but the nations. That God is going to use Israel to thresh the mountains. And thou shalt fan them, and the wind shall carry them away, and the whirlwind shall scatter them. And thou shalt rejoice in the Lord, and shalt glory in the Holy One of Israel. And folks, that has never happened. Not yet. That's a kingdom fulfillment. It's kind of interesting that throughout history, people have beaten themselves bloody trying to beat up the Jews. And when we deal with the end times, you see that accelerated. That people bloody themselves in their endeavor to wipe out the Jewish people. And when God shows up at the very end, as we alluded to in the Sunday School Hour this morning, that when God shows, or in the message this morning, that when God shows up, that the glory will be for the Lord, because Israel has nothing to look back and say, look what we did when we get to that point. God is the deliverer, and they will rejoice in glory in the Holy One of Israel instead of their own doings. after the Lord returns. If you go to Israel today, it's different than it was 100 years ago, certainly. As far as the layout of the land, it used to be it was barren hills and rocky crags and everything else, and they have covered all the land that's too steep and too rough to use for agriculture. They have covered it with trees. And the tree plantings that were done in Israel in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and early 70s have grown, and you got forests all over the steep grounds of Israel, and it's actually increased the amount of rainfall and raised the water table in Israel. Measurably. They still have drought and so on from time to time, but have had one recently. But on the whole, it has greatly improved things. But you still have areas in the south. If you go down the southern third of Israel, it is some serious desert. It's like Death Valley dry down there. And it is very barren stuff. And yet there's going to come a day when that land is no longer a barren dry desert, but rather it'll be a place of an abundance of water. It says there in verse 17, when the poor and needy seek water and there is none. We are so used to having water. Okay, I need some water. Where shall I find some water? Am I going to have to go out and dig a hole in the ground until I find some? No, I just come over and I do this. Wow, look at that. That's magic. When Lawrence of Arabia brought some Arabs to Paris and they saw one of these for the first time and they were there and they were just amazed. Water. Wow, look at this. This is just amazing. This is incredible. And when it was time for them to leave Paris, he was trying to find his, Lawrence was looking around for this handful of Arab men that had come with him. And he found them in the bathroom trying to take out the plumbing there so they could take that source of water back home with them. This magical device that produced water. And they had to explain to him, no, it comes from pipes that run, you know. Trying to find water, and there's none. The cistern is empty, the well is dry, and their tongue faileth for thirst. I, the Lord, hear them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them, and I will open rivers in high places and fountains in the midst of the valleys, and I will make the wilderness a pool of water and the dry land springs of water. In the places where it is a desert today, it will be an abundance of water. And when you've got water, it turns green. And it has the long list, and there's only one or two of these that they're pretty sure as far as what they are. It talks about I will plant in the wilderness the cedar and the shittah tree, which is the acacia, and the myrtle and the oil tree, and will set in the desert the fir tree and the pine and the box tree together. And the idea is that plants that are native there in the surrounding areas and that are normally found only in the mountains or in places where there are streams and rivers, they're going to be found all over the place. And that barren land is going to be a desert. It's kind of interesting. You look at a map of the earth, a satellite picture, and a composite where they took shots where the clouds weren't there. And it isn't just a map based on expectations, but an actual photograph of the earth. And how many places are actually green on the earth? Not a lot of them. Most of it's brown. Some of it's white, covered with snow and ice. Places where it's actually green and you can grow stuff, so people can eat and so on. Not that much of the earth. And Israel is one of those places that if you look at the satellite map, it's pretty brown. Where is it green? In places where they irrigated, along the Jordan and along the valley of Jezreel in the north and a little bit along the coast, and that's where they grow their crops today. But there's going to come a day, we talked about this a week or two ago, when the land will be a plain, as it says in Zechariah chapter 14, and the whole area will be green and lush and be able to grow things. That is kingdom fulfillment. This is not what the returning captives will find or be able to do. But this is what the Lord will do. In verse 20, that they may see and know and consider and understand together that the hand of the Lord hath done this, the Holy One of Israel hath created. This is God's doing. And again, there's going to be. This is one of the reasons God lets us run to the very end of ourselves, so that it has to be of God. It has to be of God. This is why we so often we serve a God at the last minute. He waits until it is beyond our ability to deal with, to do it ourselves, so that it is very, very evident that God did this, and therefore He gets the glory. Because otherwise, we as nasty fallen human beings would take the credit to ourselves. Now, coming back to the idea of the idols, we're going to make a God who's going to rescue us, that they had there in verse 7. So he comes back. Remember, this whole chapter here is sort of a courtroom drama. God has said to the heathen, okay, state your cause. Let's see what your gods can do. Are they going to be able to withstand Cyrus? No. And then he makes this prophecy in the middle there about what God is going to do. He makes a declaration of what God is going to do. His case, that I can tell you what the future is just as certain as the past and the present. And then he's going to come back to their idols. And here's the demand. Produce your cause, says the Lord. Bring forth your strong reasons, saith the king of Jacob. Let me pause here for just a moment. That's the only place in the scripture where that phrase is used, king of Jacob. King of Israel is used a number of times. King of Jacob is used only here. Are Jacob and Israel the same guy? Yeah. Why is it that Abram is never called Abram after his name was changed to Abraham? Okay, you notice that? He's always referred to as Abraham. He's never called Abram again. Jacob gets his name changed to Israel, and it goes back and forth. Why? It's talking about the same guy.
Depending on how he's behaving?
And the circumstances. In his, because why was his name changed?
Because his name means
deceiver. No. Why was his, when was his name changed, and what did God say? You have prevailed with God. All right? So he spent a night wrestling with God to get what he wanted from God. And he recognized that God was the source of that, and God gave it to him and changed his name. Jacob is indicating his weakness. Jacob is indicating his self-will. Jacob is indicating he's not seeking things from God. Now, it doesn't always work out, but generalization, that's true as far as the use of the name in the scripture. So, this is dealing with, remember, the second half of Isaiah is dealing with Israel's weakness. And they need encouragement. They need comfort. This is why it starts out with comfort ye my people. Because they've got bad news on top of bad news, but God has promised, I will not leave you. I will not forsake you. I'm not done with you. And so you have this comfort and this encouragement. And God is still the king, but he is, because of their status here, king of Jacob. So getting back to this, let them bring forth, he's addressing the heathen, remember, let them bring forth and show us what shall happen. Let them show the former things, what they be, and we will consider them and know the latter end of them and declare unto us things for to come. Let your idols tell us what the future is. Let your idols tell me what's going to happen tomorrow and next year and 100 years from now and 2,000 years from now. Go ahead. Do it. Go ahead and do this. Here's the charge. Here's the challenge. You do this. I've just told you, God says, what's going to happen with my people Israel. I've just told you. Now, you idols, you tell me what's going to happen. Show the things that are to come hereafter, that we may know that ye are gods. We'll know you're gods if you can pull this off. Ye do good or do evil or do anything, that we may be dismayed and behold it together. Let's see some action here. I mean, you're covered with gold and they nailed you in place. Come on, let's see something here. Let's see something that would indicate that you are capable of doing anything. And here's the conclusion. You are nothing. And your work is naught. An abomination is he that chooseth you. A fool. Putting his trust in a chunk of artwork. And so he comes back to Cyrus. I have raised up one from the north. And he will come from the rising of the sun, and he will call upon my name, and he shall come upon princes as upon mortar, and as the potter upon treading clay. You know, he's mixing up his clay so he can make something out of it, like stomping grapes. Who hath declared from the beginning that we may know it, and before time that we may say it? He is righteous, yea, there is none that showeth, yea, there is none that declareth, yea, there is none that heareth your words. Going back to the idols, that the fact that they can't do anything, they can't accomplish anything, they can't predict anything, they can't do good or bad. They're just a like the chair or the piano or the tuba or whatever else. The first shall say to Zion, behold them, and I will give to Jerusalem one that bringeth good tidings. So the world is getting all this bad news about the coming of Cyrus, that they're going to be brought under the heel of an unstoppable king and his armies. But the Jews are going to get some good news. They're going to be allowed to go back home. And they're going to be able to rebuild their city, and they're going to be able to rebuild their temple. And then he comes back to the heathen. For I beheld, and there was no man, even among them, there was no counselor, that when I asked of them, could answer a word. Talking to the idol, how are you going to help me? Can you do anything here for me? Can you do anything? And it just sits there. But God had, through the prophet here, given the message. Verse 29, behold, they are all vanity. Their words are nothing. Their molten images are wind and confusion. Understand that the word spirit and wind are the same, but in this context, he's making it very clear that what should be spirit is really just wind. All right, any questions or anything on the passage we've looked at here tonight? Encouragement for Israel, that they have the living God, and all the nations around them are serving blocks of wood and stone and metal. But they have the living God who can predict the future and has given them comfort in that good news is coming. And they'll be able to go back home after a period of time, that captivity in Babylon. All right, let's close in prayer. Father, we thank you for your word. Thank you that you are the living God. And Father, you have given us good news as well, the gospel of Jesus Christ and all the promises that come with that. Father, thank you that the kingdom is coming, that we'll be participants in that. Father, thank you for your sustaining grace even now. Father, all the different things that you have promised to us. And Father, you are a God who is alive and powerful and brings these things all to pass. And Father, nothing can be thwarted, nothing can be undermined, nothing can be changed as far as your decree is concerned. And Father, thank you that we have a God we can rely on. Give us comfort and give us encouragement as you did to Israel in their day. We pray for Christ's sake. Amen.